Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your host for this weekend show. This weekend show very much focused on the commodity sectors. First half of the show, we're going to be focusing on opportunities in more of the metals areas. And back half of the show, we're going to look to the energy sectors, oil and natural gas, which with how well metals and metal stocks are doing, boy, oh boy, the oil and natural gas sectors have been pretty boring. Lack of price movements on the commodity price front. And the stocks, you can still find individual stories, but you need to be a lot more selective in that energy sector. Just as a note, please go back through our website, kereport.com, or podcast on your podcast player. Just search the KE Report. You can also find us on YouTube and Substack by searching the KE Report to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates. Without further ado, let's get into this weekend show as we're chatting with Matt Geiger. Matt is the managing partner at MJG Capital. We both got to see you down at the Beaver Creek Conference, Matt. We shared our thoughts on that conference the week after. We've had some other commentators share their thoughts. And quite frankly, across the board, everyone just outlining how enthusiastic, how bullish that environment was. Curious what you saw in terms of sentiment at that conference.
Well, first, Corey, I'll say it was great grabbing a beer and actually spending some time in person. We had Trevor Hall and a couple other folks join us. I really enjoyed that. And it's always more fun to spend time in person, you know, versus discussing things over the phone or over Zoom as we do so often. So that's one of the reasons I really, really value these conferences. In terms of the sentiment and what I saw at Beaver Creek, I mean, I only started attending Beaver Creek in 2019. To be clear. So I can't claim to have attended every one of these conferences going back to its inception a little bit over a decade ago. But what I can say is that the mood was more upbeat and optimistic than at any of the Beaver Creeks that I've attended previously. From a numbers perspective, I saw some figures from Paul Harris. The number of companies participating jumped 38% from the previous year. And on the investor side, the number of participants was roughly 20% higher than it was in 2024. So pretty marked increases on both fronts. But I should note this doesn't account for the number of, you know, industry participants that are hanging around the conference and not participating formally, but are there at the bar and grill and, you know, participating in meetings off the books. And I can say that the numbers were markedly higher of folks that fall into that category relative to what we've seen in the most recent years. So it is certainly exciting to see energy returning to this sector, and there was plenty of energy at the conference, but it does make the contrarian side of me somewhat nervous. But when I say this, I did not witness the type of enthusiasm one would expect to see at the very peak of a secular bull market. We didn't see that level of exuberance, but what I did see indicated to me that a pullback or at least some consolidation is very likely in order, particularly as it pertains to gold, silver, and the associated mining equities.
Well, Matt, with that frame of mind and the bullishness that you saw in the precious metals, where do you think the best opportunities are today? Because a lot of these stocks have run 1x, 2x, 3x. So you can understand why people at Beaver Creek were pretty excited. You can understand where the enthusiasm's coming from. Everybody feels smart in a bull market. And as our friend Rick Rule always says, we don't want to confuse a bull market with brains. But at this point, it's getting harder to find the opportunities in the gold and silver space. So where do you see the opportunities there? Or have the opportunities shifted into other commodities?
Well, I think it's very important to draw a distinction between gold and silver and really the rest of the metals complex. And I would argue gold and silver are more advanced in their cycles. You know, as a very imperfect yardstick, the price of physical gold advanced roughly 7 times between the trough in the early 2000s and the peak of that bull market in 2011. So were this cycle to play out exactly the same way, which to be very clear, it won't, but this is just a rough yardstick. were the cycle to play out the very same way, we'd be almost exactly 50% through this move, given that gold is up 3.5 times from its late 2015 lows. And I think silver perking up quite noticeably in the past 60 days or so signals to me, at least, is another data point that we're in the middle innings of this move in precious metals. So I think in terms of where we go next, I think we see the baton handed off to copper in pretty short order here. I'll point to the copper-gold ratio, which is now lower than it was during the depths of the COVID panic in spring of 2020, which is pretty shocking, and I think that's unsustainable over any reasonable period of time. We've also seen a number of supply disruptions in recent weeks. Actually, just today, we saw force majeure declared at Grasberg, which is the world's second largest copper mine, after a landslide killed two employees with five more missing. So I send prayers to the missing employees and hope that they're found safely. And it's also been reported that there's been damage sustained to key infrastructure at Grasberg. So that's a huge deal. And then just earlier this week, we saw operations pause at Constancia in Peru. That's Hudbay Minerals, due to social unrest near the mine. And this is all on top of the tunnel collapse at El Teniente last month, which has seen a decent percentage of that mine's production put offline for the indefinite future. So I think copper should be in store for a little bit of a run here between these snowballing supply disruptions and also its historical cheapness relative to gold. And I should note, it's cheaper than it was during the depths of the COVID pandemic liquidation. I think if you look back all the way to 1980, we haven't seen copper as cheap as it is relative to gold right now. So the stage is set. With all that said, I should note that the MJG partnership has its highest weighting towards copper-focused companies, at roughly 45% of our overall portfolio. So I think it's good to acknowledge that this may be coloring my perspective somewhat as I make these points.
Hey, no problem with talking your own book there, Matt, but I do want to dive a little bit more into that then. Since you want to talk your book, or since you mentioned it, what stage of copper companies are you looking at? Because there are a handful, I would say, that seem to be ready to be built, but those price tags or permitting are still, I guess, in a way, delaying those from being built. There's a ton of explorers out there, but it costs so much money to explore for large copper systems. We keep hearing from these juniors that they're always looking for partners, and some of these partnerships have been slow to come by. So where have you been focusing the portfolio?
Early stage. Yeah, very early stage, in short. We do have some royalty exposure to copper via Altius Minerals, as well as Elemental, which are two companies I've written about in recent MJG partnership letters. But I actually don't consider either of them copper-focused companies per se. In terms of our copper-focused names, we have a couple developers, two that I've also written about in recent MJG letters include Lara Exploration and their development stage Plan Alto project down in Brazil, and then Corex Copper and its Habe project in Namibia, where we just saw a PEA come out a few weeks ago. And then other than that, all our copper exposure comes through either primarily through prospect generators and then in a couple exploration stage names. So we're definitely down cap as it pertains to copper. But I think that should serve us quite well, because in a general sense, we are seeing money come down cap into exploration stage names. I would pinpoint kind of late April to early May is when we started to see that phenomenon take place. And it's really only accelerated in the following months.
Well, we'll definitely keep tabs on the copper sector across all stages, the exploration, development, and production. And there's still a lot of opportunity to rotate some precious metals funds into the copper space for the longer bull cycle it has. But like you say, there's really a distinction between the precious metals and the rest of the commodities. But you did bring up some of the royalty companies in that answer on copper. And when you mentioned the copper exposure you have through Elemental Altus, it made me think of what we just saw in Beaver Creek, Matt, where right before the conference, the big news dropped about the merger of Elemental Altus Royalties with EMX Royalty Corp to form a new pro forma mid-tier company in the space. We've interviewed the company this week, and we've had some other people weigh in on it, but love to get your thoughts on what this means for the sector to have these two companies come together, but also weave in the angle of the Tether investment angle with Elemental Altus and how the crypto money has found the precious metal sector.
Sure, I'd be happy to. In terms of the deal itself, look, I'm quite constructive on the deal. And honestly, I wanted to see Elemental and EMX join forces years ago. I think it's okay to say this now that the dust has settled, but these are two teams that have been, in on and off M&A discussions for a couple years now. And honestly, I became a bit jaded when I didn't see a deal come to fruition previously. So it was a very positive surprise to see that the news hit the wire just shortly before the Beaver Creek conference. And I do think Tether's involvement, ultimately made all the difference in getting this deal across the finish line. In terms of the aspects of the deal that I like, the first point I'll make is that these two teams are very familiar with each other at this point. I mentioned the ongoing M&A discussions that finally came to fruition, but also remember that they syndicated the Caserones royalty together back in 2021. And it's my understanding that they worked very hard and got very close to syndicating another royalty deal in the following years. So these are two groups that know each other very well. There's also the overlap of key royalties, with Caserones being the key one, and that will be a flagship for the combined companies going forward. But also Arizona Sonoran's Cactus Project. And perhaps more importantly, from an overlap perspective, there's the overlap in the company's shareholder bases with investors like Paul Stevens, Adrian Day, Darren Milmeister at Extract Capital coming to mind as long-term supporters of both of these companies. And finally, I do like that the combined company will continue with EMX's royalty generation business at its current run rate. So I do think this is a very nice differentiator over most all of the company's peer group, with the exceptions of Altius and Origin. So a lot to like about the deal. I will say there are a couple aspects that I didn't like. The first is that Tether conducted a concurrent $100 million financing at a 10% discount to Elemental's closing price on the deal on the day that the deal was announced. Tether will argue that even considering this discount, this money came at a lower cost of capital than if Elemental had gone to the banks and raised a similar amount of capital. And while I think that's probably true, I think it would have gone a long way for Tether to have either opened this financing up to existing Elemental shareholders to participate as well, or just have done the deal at Elemental's closing price on the day the deal was announced. So one nitpick there. And then another point, I think it is a big loss that Sandeep Singh will not be serving on the combined company's boards. He has deep experience in the royalty space between his time as CEO of Osisko Royalties and also his time as a banker. So I was disappointed to not see him included on the combined board going forward. But with all that said, while it's not a perfect deal from my perspective, I do think the pros very much outweigh the cons. And from a general sense, as a close follower of the royalty space, it's exciting to me to see one less name on the board as we look to the junior names.
Yeah, I love this scaling up, but to the point of what the strategy is going to be with EMX and Elemental taking, in a way, different tacks to generate royalties with Tether in the game, do you expect this combined company to be a whole lot more aggressive now that it seems like they have just different funding options available to them?
Sure. I mean, I know Tether is pedal to the metal. They want to grow aggressively. And I will say it's incumbent on Dave Cole, Fred, Dave Baker, Stefan Wanger, who will be the combined company's CFO, to push back on Tether when necessary. I think this company is going to grow, it's going to be aggressive, but it needs to be the right deals at the right price. So as a shareholder of the combined company, I'll be tracking each and every one of their deals closely to make sure that they're remaining disciplined. With that said, I think there's tremendous opportunity here. With this merger, this makes Elemental now one of three companies in kind of the $1 to $10 billion snack bracket in terms of precious metal focused royalty companies. And the other two are Triple Flag and OR. And as I think we've discussed previously, I still think there is a decent chance that we do ultimately see a merger between OR and Triple Flag. And thinking ahead, were this to be the case, that would leave Elemental as the only precious metal focused royalty company in that US, you know, $1 to $10 billion snack bracket. So I think that will provide them with an interesting niche in which to grow their business. But it's clear that Tether will be there for support. And I think it's also more clear, you know, what Tether's ultimate strategy is here. You know, when Tether announced the Elemental deal initially, there are a whole bunch of different routes they could have gone down. You know, the acquisition of that controlling stake could have been a means to taking over Elemental entirely. That does not seem to be the direction they're going. It could have been a sign that Tether was going to go out and acquire more controlling stakes and other junior royalty peers. That does not appear to be the path that they're going. You know, there was some discussion of Tether maybe syndicating royalties with Elemental so that they could own them outright. That does not seem to be the direction they're going. And I wrote about this in the most recent MJG investor letter, and my conclusion is that they were going to do largely what they're doing now, which is use Elemental as their growth vehicle in the royalty space to both opportunistically acquire peers and, when value is not on offer, to evaluate individual royalty and streaming purchases as they come up.
Yeah, man, I think you're spot on there. And again, in talking with the company, both at Beaver Creek and just even recently this week on our show, they made that point again that, you know, it doesn't seem that Tether has any interest in just taking them over. That would stop the new deal flow. And it doesn't seem any interest in doing their own syndication of deals. They really want to use this vehicle, the new combined pro forma Elemental Royalty Corp is what it'll be called, to go out and make acquisitions and grow the company that way. But it does bring up, you brought up a great point about them being really the only company that'll be left in the mid-tier snack bracket, especially the smaller mid-tier. And I guess you and I feel a little differently about the less names on the boards. I actually like seeing the choice in the different styles of royalty companies, but there are a lot, probably a dozen sub $1 billion junior companies. So it is nice to see this middle of the road company. Do you think that gives them more optionality around doing deals that are maybe too small for the big guys, but too big for the little guys? Does it give them a unique edge to do kind of mid-tier sized deals?
Well, just to put a pin in your previous point, we have had this discussion, this friendly disagreement before. And the reason why I think less is more in terms of the junior royalty names is, look, this is a very, very competitive industry at this point. And it's competitive on a couple fronts. First, on finding actual deals in which to grow. And secondly, in terms of cost of capital, which can be lessened by attracting investors, raising your share price, and you can justify paying higher valuations for deals that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So from my perspective, the less names that are on the board, the less competition there is for deals, and the less competition there is for investor eyeballs. So that's why I'm pretty steadfast on this point. You know, as we look to the combined Elemental and EMX, just on the cost of capital front, you know, we're looking at a near-term listing here in the U.S., most likely on the NASDAQ. So that's going to result in indexation. So we should see some passive inflows into the stock through that. And I think given their size, it's quite likely, you know, speaking this time next year, that we'll see Elemental included on both the GDXJ and the GDX. So that could be some additional passive inflows coming its way. But, you know, to your point, you know, both companies have re-rated on the back of this acquisition, but we're still, you know, only looking at a combined company worth over $1 billion US and change. So they can afford to look at some of the smaller deals that will still move the needle for them, you know, relative to certainly a Franco or a Wheaton, but, you know, even to a Triple Flag or an OR. So I think for the time being, they occupy a pretty interesting niche. And to that capital point, they're going to be able to afford to pay a little bit more for potential acquisitions than, you know, the Metallas or the Groys of the world that may be looking at similar deals.
That's such a key distinction right there, is the, again, access to capital, their ability to make deals. Look, that merger taken very positively by the market. Let's also step back to more touching on some of these major companies or larger companies taking stakes in juniors through either exploration or looking at helping to develop some of their projects. You brought up Centerra Gold and their recent stake in Liberty Gold. Look, Centerra is actually in a few companies in terms of helping to fund exploration, really using these other companies maybe as a bit of an exploration wing. What's your take on Centerra Gold, even the bigger picture, some of these larger companies dabbling in the junior space, mostly through equity investments?
Yeah, I mean, I've been following Centerra's moves very closely here over the past 18 months. You know, from a high-level perspective, I think this has been a very shrewd strategy from Centerra. Really, since the Kenderland investment in early 2024, they've proactively gone out and taken strategic equity stakes in a number of well-run juniors. Kenderland was the first. That was followed by Headwater Gold. That was followed by Azimut and Midland up in Quebec, Dryden Gold. And then most recently, during the Beaver Creek Conference, they announced a strategic investment in Liberty Gold. So with the exception of Liberty, which I think is, you know, should fairly be characterized as a later stage developer, each of these companies are either a prospect generator or in the case of Dryden, an early stage explorer. And this makes me think of Neil Adshead's recent post on LinkedIn, where he showed that of the 30 major precious metal miners in North America, they're returning nearly six times more to shareholders via either dividends or share buybacks versus what they're dedicating to exploration spend. So I think in this respect, Centerra is really zigging while its peers are zagging, as Centerra doubles down on early stage exploration. And I ultimately think it's going to serve the company well by establishing these relations with well-run early stage exploration groups, you know, before their peers try to do the same. Because I do think as the cycle advances, we're going to see this, you know, 6x ratio that Neil points to come down as some of Centerra's or most of Centerra's peers follow its playbook. And, you know, I should also note this has been very relevant, you know, to the MJG partnership, as we've been, you know, long-term shareholders of Kenderland and are now co-invested with Centerra there. And we're also recent shareholders of Headwater Gold through their most recent private placement, where Centerra followed their check and topped up their 9.9% strategic stake there. You know, we're also invested in Scout Discoveries, which announced a project level deal. So to be clear, this was not an equity stake, but a project level deal with Centerra at Scout's Lehman Butte project in Idaho. But I think even for those that are not, you know, directly invested alongside Centerra, for those that are interested in early stage exploration, particularly in North America, where all of these deals have taken place, I think it would be smart for investors to follow Centerra's moves very closely, because I think we have more to come.
Yeah, man, I think it's an interesting point that they're zigging when others zag, and that they're really investing in the early stage of the cycle, the exploration, the prospect generation side, as well as the development stage, Liberty, but still has exploration on its cards as well. But there's the argument that some people make that it's better to see people come in at a project level basis or a company level basis, or that they like to see, you know, companies that'll continue to top up versus taking a one-time stake, because a 9% stake over time could get diluted down. Where do you stand on that debate as far as how strategic partnerships are most advantageous, I guess, from both sides, to the major or to the junior?
Yeah, well, I think in short, it's very much case by case. You know, I should also note that it's a little bit of a false choice, because in the case of Centerra, you know, for Kenderland, for instance, we've seen them take both a strategic equity stake, but also get active on the project level, originally with the Hunter project, and, you know, more recently in recent months, a handful of projects in northwestern Ontario. So sometimes a strategic stake can lead to project level investments. And who knows, we may see the same for Headwater or for Azimut or for Midland. So I think investors should keep their eyes to that. In terms of the debate, one or the other, I think it depends on the junior's cash position. And I also think it depends on the premium or lack thereof that the strategic is willing to pay. So if the junior's already fully cashed up with no need for capital for, you know, a 3+ year time period, then as an investor, I would be much more interested in a project level stake. But conversely, if the company only has a year or a year and a half of runway, and the strategic stake could ultimately lead to project level investments, Like I think it's something that should be taken seriously. And then there's also just the validation that comes, from a 20, 30, 50 million market capper, taking on money from a group of Centerra's stature and size. So I also think it helps more broadly from a cost of capital perspective as well.
Matt, when we're talking about these exploration companies, a lot of explorers have also been running. This summer was a great time for these juniors. Even without news being released, we are in that environment where stocks are running ahead of drill results outside of these companies having, I guess, major backers or large companies supporting them. What do you do? What are you looking for when you see this environment where, again, juniors are running without drill results. Good drill results are still pushing stocks higher, but what do you do in your portfolio when you see those kind of movements?
Take profits. Any time that you've invested in a company with a specific thesis for a drill program, and you see that company climb 75, 100% in share price ahead of results, that's a great opportunity to de-risk. Whether that's selling, a portion of your percentage position, whether that's taking your entire cost basis off the table, that's kind of an individual decision and can be done on a case-by-case basis. But I think anytime you see a substantial re-rate purely based on hype, it is prudent to be doing at least some selling. I'll also just say from a general sense, and we've done plenty of these podcasts over the years, you guys will be well aware, like we've been fully deployed, all of 2024 and through the first 5 months of 2025. So a good 17 months of basically having a 0 or 1% cash position. I should note that we've been taking profits in quite a few of our names and liquidating a couple as well, where I don't think the investment thesis has played out. So the fund is, currently at around a 12% cash position. And we're well on our way to the mid or high teens. So I think it is prudent, when the going is good, you don't have to throw in the towel on the whole sector by any means, but when the going is good, take some money off the table, stash that away for a rainy day, because nothing goes up forever and there will be better buying opportunities, whether it's later this year or sometime next. I'm pretty confident in that, at least for the gold and silver names in particular. You could maybe make a different argument for kind of the rest of the commodity complex, which I think does have some catching up to do.
Matt, I think this topic is so fascinating. There are so many podcasts out there, not just our channel, but so many channels talking about when to buy, always time to buy, always a sector to buy, but so few that talk about when to pull profits, when to sell, when to go to cash. And what we see during big panics, like when we saw the April tariff tantrums, or if you think back to the pandemic crash of 2020 or the great financial crisis, a lot of people go to cash at the bottom of a cycle in a panic move, and they raise cash at the totally wrong time. Very few people talk about raising cash when times are good, and it's a delicate balance of when to hold on to the winners and let your winners run and when to start scaling out. But when you raise that cash, so in your case, you're going from a 1% to a 12% cash position, as you say, you can wait for the rainy day and average back into some positions. Do you find yourself having the propensity to get new positions with that cash? Or to go back in positions you had that you scaled out of and have now pulled back to a better price? Or are you more interested in reloading the boat on a horse that's been winning for you and you think it can keep winning? Or are you more propensity to start new positions with that cash that you've raised?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, for myself specifically, it's a mix. It'll really depend on a case-by-case basis. I'm obviously more comfortable, with the names that we own within the portfolio. I own them for a reason. And so if in a panic-like scenario, we have an opportunity to average down on our cost basis, and I believe, firmly that the investment thesis remains very much intact, that is generally going to be my preference. But I also think in times of fear and times of panic, that you can also look to the very high quality names that maybe ran away from you in the previous up move and that you wanted to own, but perhaps didn't think it made sense from a valuation perspective. So you can kind of shift your portfolio to quality when everything else is on sale. So in terms of the new names that would be coming in, it's really the higher quality companies that I wish we'd owned for the previous run up, but didn't for one reason or another. And now's our opportunity to take a stake, settle in and hopefully profit when the market inevitably turns.
All right, time to wrap it up here, Matt. Thank you for your insights. Look, again, it continues to be a very good environment for especially precious metals investors, but you've outlined some opportunities also in the copper space. And right now, yes, if you are harvesting some of those gains, which might not be a horrible idea, just have a plan of what you're going to do with that. And everything is more or less a case-by-case basis. Again, Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Click the link in the show notes to learn more about Matt's fund and MJG Capital. Matt, thank you, as always, for your time. It's great having you on the show. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back, shifting our focus to the oil and natural gas sector.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.